This is Mae Bressel. It is tape 854, April the 18th, 1988. Last week I suggested that you send your subscription renewals to me here at the house so that I can become familiar with the new subscribers, but I'm going to change that back again. I can get a list of subscribers from Betty Phillips at the Tape Center and from Al Kunzer. So do as you've been doing before. Send your renewals and your subscriptions to those two people, and I can get the list from them of the people who are taking the tapes. I've been talking previously on one or two broadcasts about the murder of an Indian in Lumberton County, North Carolina, a situation where Julian Pierce was about to get an appointment as a judicial candidate. It's a very controversial area there with a lot of racism and problems with Indians and blacks as well. Two men were arrested for the murder of Mr. Pierce. One was Sandy Chavis, C-H-A-V-I-S, a Lumbee Indian, was arrested with a murder warrant out for him, and another, John Anderson Goins, G-O-I-N-S. And Mr. Chavis testified or told the powers that be in a confession. He didn't confess his own self doing the murder. He said that Mr. Goins pulled the trigger on the shotgun that killed Mr. Pierce. And, of course, it was Mr. Goins who was found dead in a cell, and that case, I suppose, is now closed. Mr. Goins, it turns out, was a security guard in Raleigh, North Carolina, and it reminded me of Thane Caesar, the security guard who pulled the gun from behind the back of Robert Kennedy, and Sirhan took the penalty for the fatal bullet that killed Robert Kennedy. So the person who had shot Mr. Pierce, according to one of the two parties, was a security guard. The reason I bring this up again, and many of you might have seen these instances of quick death, such as Lee Harvey Oswald, or this particular Mr. Goins being dead as soon as he's fingered as the person who did the murder, but the political implications follow the same pattern also and are very significant. In the New York Times, there's just a brief article: opponent of slain candidate declares himself the winner. That's very easy to do when the other person is dead. A judgeship candidate whose rival was slain last week asked the governor, James Martin, not to call a special legislative session that would allow a candidate from a minority group to enter the race. That's about as clear as you can get it for a motive to kill somebody in a very dangerous area where Indians and blacks are not wanted. The governor met with the district attorney, Joe Freeman Britt, who declared himself the rightful Democratic nominee for Superior Court judge in the racially troubled Robeson County. And he will win the judgeship in November since no Republican is seeking the seat. And he told the governor, don't allow any other candidate from a minority group to enter. So therefore, the case is all sealed and set, and the judgeship will go to another probably controversial white judge, and the man who possibly shot this candidate is dead himself. Case closed, and goodness knows what kind of justice will take place in that town in North Carolina. Now, there's a big change happening through our Democratic Party, through the Democratic Party, not ours, you may be Republicans, that is going to affect the way the Congress looks next year. And I wonder if you're adding it up. Maybe you are, maybe you are not. I thought I'd go over it with you. The New York Times had a long article on Joe Biden. This was dated February 27, 1988, how Mr. Biden, for several months, had a silent time bomb in his head that almost killed him, that he suffered from neck pain that they believed was a viral infection. And this article goes on with the importance of chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, who started wearing a brace in January during the hearings on the nomination of Anthony Kennedy. Now, while he was listening and defeating the nomination of Robert Bork, he wasn't wearing a neck brace and his neck didn't hurt. His neck only hurt when he defeated Bork very loud and clearly, and after that he had this aneurysm that has kept him silent so far. There's only been a picture of him. He's had two surgeries, and Joe Biden went into a smaller hospital, Wilmington, Delaware Hospital, for tests, and within hours he was taken to the Army Hospital, Walter Reed Army Hospital, where he had a six-hour operation. And as I say, we haven't seen or heard a word about Joe Biden since his two surgeries. Now, Senator Robert Byrd spoke up just last week and referred to Attorney General Meese as the king of sleaze. And within a week, less than a week's time, Robert Byrd announced that he's giving up his important leadership in the Democratic Party as the speaker for the Senate, the Democratic leader for the Senate. And I wonder if somebody got to him. He was attacking the king of sleaze. Of course, Larry Speaks had to resign from Merrill Lynch as soon as he revealed tales that he wrote press releases for President Ronald Reagan. But Meese is a holy cow in Washington, it seems, and Senator Byrd quickly gave up his important position after talking about the Attorney General. Representative Edward Boland, Democrat, the author of the Boland Amendment, who was instrumental in stopping arms to the Contras after the mining of the harbor, announced that he is retiring from Congress. So we have Meese as the person attacked by Byrd. Byrd won't be in Congress next year. Representative Edward Boland is also resigning, and he played a major role in turning the events around in Nicaragua. Democratic Peter Rodino of New Jersey is not seeking election again. He was responsible for the Office of Immigration that returned the facts about Nazis in this country, war criminals in this country, and was an important factor in deporting some Nazis out of the United States. Patrick Buchanan was working hard to keep those Nazis in the United States. Of course, he loves Edwin Meese, too. So Peter Rodino will not be in Congress next year. William Proxmire is leaving the Congress. He was the watchdog on the Pentagon waste, money waste in the Pentagon. So the man who attacked Robert Byrd is very ill and has a chance of another blood clot at any time, making him drop dead. Rodino, who was watching the Nazis in the United States, won't be there. Boland, who was watching the arms go to the Contras, won't be there. Robert Byrd will give up his mouthpiece as spokesman for the Democrats in the Senate. And Proxmire, who watched the Pentagon waste, will not be there. Those are big changes that have been announced just in the past 2 weeks. The Wall Street Journal had an article that has as much arrogance as many that I've seen, more than I've seen in a long, long time, April 13th, this past week. It's about the Trilateral Commission meeting in Japan, and it's written by Robert Bartley, a member of the Trilateral Commission. The title is Trilateral Diary on the Usefulness of Establishments. And this article goes along with the broadcasts and material I've done on how policies are made 20 years in advance, that a team such as Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski and Fred Ickley write down what the next president has to do, whether he's a Democrat or Republican. And this article goes along those lines. The article is about the meeting in Japan, and the Trilateral Commission, he explains, was founded 15 years ago to add Japan to the European North American economic political dialogue, to include them. And now some fear they'd be the economic overlord of even the United States. And this article tells back in New Hampshire, Republican primary in 1980, the late publisher William Loeb turned his unique talents to making a boogeyman out of the innocuous Trilateral Commission. George Bush, the principal opponent of Loeb's favorite, Ronald Reagan, was a trilateralist, and of course he's part of the Order of the Skull and Crossbones and a trilateralist, and will hopefully be the president of the United States on the Republican ticket. Bush is a trilateralist. Loeb didn't like them at the time, and this author said it, but Jimmy Carter, who didn't know anyone else outside of Georgia, staffed his high on foreign policy with trilateralists and right-wing ones at that, such as Zbigniew Brzezinski and Harold Brown. And he also then used Caspar Weinberger. Ronald Reagan used Caspar Weinberger, who's a member of the Trilateral Commission, as soon as Reagan was president. And the article says, a later makeup meeting between President Reagan and Mr. Rockefeller never erased the image, no doubt partly because of the editorials branding the 1980 episode as nonsense at a time And this editor who's writing this story attended some of these meetings where the confrontation came up between Rockefeller and Reagan. And the important thing about this, many important things, is that Nelson Rockefeller is not alive and Ronald Reagan is the president. Weinberger of the Trilateral was on his cabinet. Then the article continues about the successfulness of Japan, the part of the Trilateral Commission, who at this time could sell the Imperial Palace in Tokyo and would have enough money to buy California. Right now, they have enough cash to buy almost all of our banks. But the conclusion of the article goes this way. For Mr. Rockefeller, he saw 15 years ago that the world is becoming one economy, transcending political sovereignties. Somehow institutions, indeed establishments, need to be developed to cope with this reality. Institutions, let me say this again from Robert Bartley, a trilateralist and a writer, editor for the Wall Street Journal. He said, our institutions and establishments have to cope with the reality that the world is one economy and it transcends political sovereignties. If the next U.S. president is Mr. Bush, a trilateralist, it will be good because he has his foot in both the Trilateral Commission and the Reagan camps. Or if the next president is another callow governor with no world experience, it will not be good if he must fill his post with strangers or natives of one state, especially the state of Massachusetts. What Robert Bartley is saying, that when if Dukakis were to become president, he would have to take a cabinet from the Trilateral Commission, identical to what Jimmy Carter did, because the trilateralists recognize that the world is one economy transcending political sovereignties and that you need the institutions and establishments to develop this reality. This is their reality. The title of the article is Trilateral Diary on the Usefulness of Establishments, and that the new president, if he just happens to be a Democrat, has to face the reality of the world. Now, some of you might remember the words of Paddy Chayefsky, an author who had an untimely early death, who wrote Network. It was a movie, came out in a book in 1976. And if you remember, the television gentleman there was taken into a hall, similar to the referred to Valhalla, and he was told to sit down. Mr. Howard was told to sit down, and he was in front of a screen, a lectern screen, where he was to get a lecture from Mr. Jensen. And Mr. Jensen said to him, in quotes, "You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale. I won't have it." He says, "I won't have it. Is that clear? You think you have merely stopped a business deal, and that's not the case. The Arabs have taken billions out of this country, and now they must put it back," which is similar to Japan putting things back in this country. He said, "It's ebb and flow, it's tidal gravity, it's ecological balance. You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and people. There are no nations, there are no people, there are no Russians, no Arabs, no third world. There is no West. There is one holistic system of systems, one vast and immane, interwoven, interacting, multivariate, multinational domination of dollars, petrodollars, electrodollars, multidollars," and he goes on. He said, "That is the natural order of things today." And I've quoted this on other broadcasts earlier in the past years. It's so important, but it comes up again in the Wall Street Journal today. And he goes on to saying to Mr. Beale, "That is the atomic, subatomic, galactic structure of things today, and you have meddled with the primal forces of nature, and you will atone. Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?" And being as Mr. Beale is Paddy Chayefsky, and Paddy Chayefsky is dead, he does indeed atone. And then he says, "You get up on your little 21-inch screen, Mr. Beale, and you howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM, ITT, ATT, DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. These are the nations of the world. Now, what do you think of that? What do you think the Russians talk about? We no longer live in a world of nations and ideologies. The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been that way since it crawled out of the slime, and our children will live to see the perfect world where there's no war, famine, or oppression, and so forth. He said, where there's a vast ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work to serve a common share of stock. All their necessities will be provided, and all their anxieties tranquilized. And, of course, you know the methods of tranquilization that will be used. Now, getting away from Wall Street Journal and the determination and blatant statement of what kind of a cabinet Mr. Dukakis will take. He doesn't even refer to Jesse Jackson as if he has a chance. I want to continue with a subject I briefly mentioned when I talked about the King of Sleaze. That was Edwin Meese and the fact that Howard Bender family that paid Ursula Meese $40,000 a year for the next 3 years was receiving $7.1 million from U.S. taxes and the Justice Department for the rental of their offices. But the story got to be even worse in the past week, and I want to summarize it for you. I know most of you have seen articles on the scandal of the Justice Department renting a building from the Bender family and what happened, the convoluted context of this case, but I want to put in chronological order because it is so horrendous. First of all, there's this E. Robert Wallach, who plays a part in this selection of meeting people. The Benders and the Meeses friendship goes way back. But one article said that George Walker, the attorney for E. Robert Wallach's matters, said that Wallach did play a peripheral role in Mrs. Meese's job with the Multiple Sclerosis Society. They got their foot into that door. In the fall of 1985, the Bender Foundation said it would give $120,000 to the MS Society. Mr. Bender's wife, Sandra, was a board member, and if they put Mrs. Meese, who was a volunteer, on the payroll, $40,000 annually, they would give the society $120,000. So Mr. Robert Wallach played a role some way in getting her the job with the MS Society. First, they were going to get her with a radio station and settle for this one, but I guess he was the scout and fixer for a job that Mrs. Meese could have. Now, in 1984, the government gave notice that they were going to move the immigration services to new quarters, and Congress approved the specific order and went through the plans for the move, in which 63% of what was leased at that time would not be used by the Justice Department. In March 1985, the Chester Arthur Building was bought by the Bender family for $37.5 million, and they paid twice the assessed value for some reason or other. But at this time, the Justice Department lease was about to expire. June of 1985, 3 months after they bought the building, there were complaints that workers there were getting sick, that the Benders promised to correct the problem. It came from the air circulation system. June 1985, 3 months after they bought the building, the Justice Department told the Congress, "We change our mind, we're not going to move," and they would sign a lease, this time with the Benders, the Bender family, friends of the Meeses. And by June 85, they were to take hold of this building, and the government would lease from them. The environmental impact study was ordered from the General Services Administration. In the fall of 85, the Benders tried to get Ursula Meese on the payroll of some company. First, they tried WWDC radio station in Washington, then they settled for the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation. January the 1st, 1986, Mrs. Meese started to get her salary, guaranteed $40,000 for 3 years. In May of 86, 5 months later, this huge lease was signed with the Benders after she was assured her money, and the government promised them $50 million over the next 10 years. Now, this is the week of tax paying, so you might appreciate what is happening here. The lease that the government gave the Benders was 3 times what they paid the rent before, and they signed it even though the building was a health hazard. May 14th, 1987, the Benders signed a new lease on the condition that they clean up the air conditioning in 86. And 13 days after the lease was absolutely signed, they sold the building for $60 million and made a profit in 2 years of $22.7 million. What made their profit possible was that we taxpayers were paying three times the lease price before of $50 million. And with that extra three times what it was worth, they then sold it for $60 million, and they in turn made $22 million after assuring and signing an agreement that Mrs. Meese get a mere $120,000 out of all this. Now, Mr. Seymour Glanzer is an attorney for the Bender family. James Rocap is the attorney for the Meeses. He said the attorney general was aware of the lease, that it was up, and that the air system was not cleaned out. And the Monterey Herald had a story that went this way. At the Immigration Service, Assistant Commissioner James Kennedy said it was his job to recommend to Commissioner Alan C. Nelson, this is the Immigration Office's, to Alan C. Nelson, whether to renew the lease on the Chester Arthur building that was owned by the Benders, or should they move as planned, as Congress had planned. The Immigration Service Commissioner went to his boss to see if they should move or renew the lease. And the article continues, if Alan Nelson, he's a personal friend of Edwin Meese's, from they worked together in California, he's now head of the immigration. If he wanted to move, the General Services Administration would have found a different location. But Nelson, a long friend of Meese's from California, agreed to rent the building from Edwin and Ursula Meese's other friends, the Benders. And Ursula had just been promised $120 million for 3 years. So the decision was in the hands of Commissioner Alan C. Nelson, who's a long friend of the Meese's. And if he was not a friend, he could have taken the lease away, but he gave it to the Benders, and the Benders assured Mrs. Meese a job. Meese is surely the king of sleaze, and the implications here are horrendous, and the profit of $22.7 million in just 2 years tells one of the most shocking stories about Meese. A lot has been shocking, but this is simply horrendous. Now, when Meese was up for becoming Attorney General, there was an investigation in some of his scandals, and one of them had to do with, this is an article from the Wall Street Journal, March 14, 1984, Reagan picks head of General Services Administration, a man who was sued over practices in selling businesses. And I did a broadcast a long time ago about Mr. Cordemanche and lying about the money he had, the debts he had, the bonuses he took, the huge bonuses. Cordemanche didn't become head of GSA because of all the scandals, but he became the man in charge of Nancy Reagan's travel and public relations. But Reagan, in those early days, was stacking up the General Services and Office, and those were the people that account for renting these buildings. And there was another scandal with the General Services Administration. A man named Gerald Carman was leaving the General Services Administration, and Edwin Thomas was appointed to the GSA from the San Francisco Regional Office, and his brother Ted Thomas went on to Washington, D.C., and it was Ted Thomas who loaned Edwin Meese tax money, money for a Volkswagen van, and Mrs. Meese was loaned $16,000, remember, 3 days after the inauguration. So Meese went to their home in Washington from California with these big loans, and then Meese didn't declare the loan on his financial record. He didn't declare the profit or sale of stock he got from these people. And then Mrs. Meese made three times the amount of her investment that was put into the company of these various people, along with Dr. Earl Bryan, another friend who just bought United Press International. So the Meeses have a long record going back of doing these things, and they also stack the offices of the very people that make the decisions. Naturally, the appointments are there. So the big bonus went to the Bender family. The lease, the $50 million lease, went to them, and then 13 days later they sold it and made a $22 million profit in 2 years. And what made the building so profitable was that the Justice Department decided to stay there and not move, which they were going to do until Mrs. Meese got her guaranteed $120,000. Now, there was another article in the San Jose Mercury, how Meese advisor's life turned upside down. This is April the 11th, and again, this article has a lot of implications that link to other stories. This is the story of W. Franklin Chin, the money manager who has a reputation for convoluted stock deals and international money transfers. He's already been indicted for siphoning hundreds of thousands of dollars from WedTech Corporation, and Edwin Meese helped WedTech get a $32 million contract. Now, Chin is described as the mystery man with a shadowy past, and the business contacts he's had with Meese go back just several years, 1985 to 87. But Chin took $50,000 of investment made by Edwin Meese after he got a contract with him, and then started to spend $150,000 of Edwin Meese's money, which Meese didn't have. Within 18 months, he had made a 80% profit for Edwin Meese, up to $90,000. And according to this article, if Meese had made one phone call, he could have learned that Chin was not a suitable investment advisor. Well, that's a ridiculous thing to write in the San Jose Mercury, because if he'd made a phone call, then Meese wouldn't have made that big profit. So, of course, he wasn't going to call. He made a profit up to $90,000. Why would he make a phone call and blow the profit? Edwin and Ursula Meese are into making profits. But the article goes on to say that until December 87, Chin was never charged with a crime. He's involved with the WedTech story and as I say, the investments of Edwin Meese. But the story about Chin goes back to his investments in Hong Kong. The article said that he has done business in Hong Kong, London, and Cayman Islands, where people avoid their U.S. income taxes. Again, being tax week, it's appropriate to talk about where Meese's advisor goes, his financial advisor, along with the income tax money we spend to give to the vendors to rent a building for three times what it was when the lease was signed before. Now, the IRS agents are looking into Chin's work, fraudulent work, where he obtained at least $1.2 million from customers earlier using fake gold transactions and complicated maneuverings with bank accounts in Hong Kong and London. Now, Chin had two wives, W. Franklin Chin. One wife, the first wife, is the director of a bank in the Cayman Islands where he keeps his money and deposits. Chin was born in Shanghai, China. He came to California as a boy, and in 1960s, he married Shaden L. Shazley, S-H-A-Z-L-E-Y. She's the director of the Cayman Island Bank, and her father is an Egyptian diplomat who, over the years, steered wealthy Middle Eastern clients to Chin, an Egyptian diplomat. And I wondered when I read that, if that Itzko money of Richard Secord and Thomas Kleins and Eric von Marburg and that group that made all the money, millions of dollars off the Camp David Accords, had and does connect to the Egyptian wealth, the Middle East clients, and the Egyptian diplomat, who's the father of the first wife of Chin, who uses her Cayman Island banks for deposits. Chin later married again in 1980, and the host of his wedding was Charles Schwab, who had accounts at Bank of America for a while, who described himself as America's largest discount broker. Chin went into financial relationship with WedTech as a consultant. He advised Edwin Meese, and he worked with E. Robert Wallach, the man who introduced Edwin Meese to WedTech and to Chin. Chin was a friend of Wallach's. Meese was a friend of his. And now Chin and Wallach are indicted with the WedTech story. The important thing about this story article that I thought that was so interesting was the background of Chin coming from Shanghai and possible links to Chiang Kai-shek group that became very prosperous at Taiwan, married to an Egyptian woman, a father of prominence in Egypt, and a woman who is a banker, a director of a bank in the Cayman Islands, and all of these Chin's transactions for Meese, buying and selling the stock that he did all, was within the same day. At one time, he spent $140,000, and the account only allowed for $50,000. So those are some little tidbits about Edwin Meese and his advisor and the sleazy operations that are expensive because the taxpayers, of course, foot the bill for these people, and they reap in millions of dollars. We'll take a break just long enough to turn this tape over, and then I'll continue with a little bit more about Mrs. Meese, the Multiple Sclerosis Association, and some of these foundations to raise money for medical purposes.